For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and this week's show is recorded live on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Welcome to part one of my trip to the Wigtown Book Festival 2023. I spoke to far more people than can fit into this hour, so listen out for Nigel Planer, Rory Sellin-Jones, Kate Moss, Michael Morpurgo, Joe Caulfield and Maggie O'Farrell coming up in a future edition of the show. But coming up today, Lindsay May will tell me about her debut novel, Weak Teeth. We get a weather forecast that went viral from poet Stuart Patterson. Historian Ruth Scarr discovers Napoleon through his gardens. Plus, author of books such as Platform 7 and Apple Tree Yard, Louise Doughty tells me about her new book, A Bird in Winter. All that, plus some great new audiobooks available in the RNIB library, all coming up on today's Read On Wigtown Book Festival special. First on today's show, I spoke to author Lindsay May about her debut novel, Weak Teeth. Ellis's life has crumbled without warning. Her boyfriend has fallen in love with someone else. Her job's insecure. Her bank account is empty. And she has a mouthful of unreliable teeth. Forced back to her childhood home, there's little in the way of comfort. Her mom is dating a younger man, a dentist no less, and is talking of selling a house. Her sister, Lana, is furious all the time. And a distant cousin has now arrived from the States to stay with them. During a long, hot Edinburgh summer, Ellis's world spins out of control. She's dogged by toothache, her ex won't compensate her for the flat, and somehow she's found herself stalking his new lover on Facebook. Will Ellis realise before it's too late that the bite she was born with is worth preserving? The audio version of Weak Teeth by Lindsay May is read by Scarlett Mack.
You gave me a fright. You okay?
Yeah. Well, not really. I need to talk to you.
She nods, a fresh spurt of adrenaline cutting off her reply. He's been fired. He's got a gambling problem. He's been told one of the mean things she's jokingly said about him to Becca or Zoe. She follows him into the living room. He takes the chair, leaving her the sofa they normally share.
I didn't mean for it to happen, he says.
What?
But it has, and you need to know, I've met someone else.
The world shifts. Ellis shrinks inwards.
No, she says. I'm sorry.
You... What? Who?
You don't know her. She's called Sally. We work together and honestly, Ellis, we didn't set out to hurt you. We didn't even mean it to happen.
You've slept with her?
Ellis is gripping the back of her neck, fingers working against the muscle like she could tear the thought away. It won't go.
You have, haven't you?
Ellis...
He shakes his head, but in a way that means he's sorry. The room crumples around her. But I love you.
Pathetic. Don't do this.
We can work it out. Whatever you did, you didn't mean it.
It's over.
His voice crimps in the middle as if he might cry. Instinctively, Ellis steps towards him. He recoils. Her heart cramps, and she stands wringing her hands and saying he can't be telling the truth as he walks out the room. He returns before she can catch hold of a single thought, a bag in his hand. He must have packed it already. A tiny part of her brain wonders when. The rest is a cacophony of panic. She can barely hear him speak over it.
Weak Teeth is a story about a young woman called Alice who is having a very difficult situation. She's just broken up with her partner. Well, say broken up with, she's just been dumped unceremoniously by her partner. She has to move back into her family home, which has a lot of tensions there. And she also has some very terrible problems with her teeth. So it's a story of sort of grief and bad teeth.
Leaving. He's leaving and saying she'll be fine. You can't. Where? Hers? Oh, God. Don't be. Sally would never. I've got a room at the Premier Inn. No. I'm sorry, he says. She's desperate to rewrite what's happening. Her shoulders ache to be hugged. Her ribs need to be pressed to his. It can't be true. He won't even look at her. How could you? She says.
And it's quite handy that our mother's boyfriend is a dentist.
Well, you say handy. For her, it's definitely a point of contention. She finds it very difficult to think of her mum being in that situation because her mum has had a giant phobia of dentists when they were growing up, a phobia that's passed on to Alice. And then suddenly her mother is like, well, I'm over it now and I've got a younger man and he's a dentist. So Alice definitely struggles with that.
And what was the inspiration for the book? Where did the spark come from?
I have to say that the spark definitely came from the fact that I have a difficult relationship with teeth and dentists myself and definitely had some quite traumatic experiences when I was younger. Managed to work my way out of those quite relatively successfully by adulthood. But then the book became a little bit of a sort of exposure therapy for myself in a way where it's like, write about what you're scared of and really get into the meat of that. But I also found it was a very sort of relatable problem. Loads of people have trouble with their teeth and found it a nice framework for talking about a breakup and family and sort of other elements.
So it's a nice metaphor for the state of her relationship and the state of her life.
Yeah, yes, definitely. And then also, I guess, a bit about she's in a sort of financially unstable place because she's lost the place that she was living in. And obviously at the moment, teeth care for your teeth is quite an expensive business. There's a little bit of a parallel there as well.
You must have known something like this was coming. Well, when was the last time we even had a fight? We went and bought cushions last weekend. Cushions! There's more to life than cushions, no matter how much you pretend otherwise. What are you even talking about? You know how secretive you are, how hard it is to get through to you. Me? Secretive? You're the one who's been cheating. Her voice rises to a pitch she barely recognises. I've got the room booked till the weekend, so if you could send me a message when you're... You're throwing me out. That's not fair. It's my place. Anger sweeps over her, cold and disorientating. It is his place, but it's her home. They've shared it for almost 10 years. It's filled with things she chose for them both. But you're the one that... Look, I'm not talking to you when you're like this. You can't go. But he can. He does.
And the audio version is narrated by...
It's narrated by Scarlett Mack, who did an absolutely fantastic job. I was so excited to have her. And when I got to hear some little samples beforehand. And as soon as I heard it, I could tell that she understood the kind of humour, because it's... Well, this relatively dark book in some ways. It's also quite humorous. And there's a lot of very, I think, quite specific Scottish and maybe Edinburgh humour in it as well. And she definitely, I could tell that she understood the dryness sometimes or the comedy behind what people were saying in a way that just really worked for me and made me really happy.
Do you not fancy narrating it yourself?
I would love to narrate some work, for sure. I really enjoy reading. But when they came and said, we're going to have an actor do it for you, I was like, who am I to say no? That's amazing. But yeah, I love reading my work as well. Although it's always find it easier when you don't have to have any accents. So there are characters in it who aren't from Edinburgh. And like my American accent, dreadful. So I'm very grateful to have somebody who's able to have that flexibility to do it.
And you were a recipient of a new Writers' Award with the Scottish Book Trust, now celebrating its 25th year.
Yes, I did. I received a New Writers' Award many years ago now, 10 years ago actually, and it was the start of a very long process, but it was the start of me sort of starting to take myself and my writing seriously. And from winning that, then entered other things and sort of progressed, and the career progressed. And the support that they've offered all that time has been amazing. And then I loved them so much that I ended up applying to work with their writing communities team. So I work for them 2 days a week now as well, because they're just such an amazing, supportive bunch.
Now, one thing we won't get if we're downloading the book from the RNIB Library is the cover. Can you give us a small description of the cover of Weak Teeth?
Yeah, so the cover, the main image on the cover is of an apple with a big bite taken out of it, and then the title is written within the apple itself in white. I think the main reason behind it is the fact that when you have bad teeth, the thought of biting out of an apple is quite scary. So it was a nice sort of friendly version of some of the contents of the book. We did have some versions that had big mouths and teeth and things like that, but they were creeping people out a little bit. So we were like, no, we'll go with the lovely apple that has the turquoisey teal and pink.
And Lindsay will be back at the end of the show with the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show, this week recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. But now, the weather. Wheen is a collection of more than 100 poems by Stuart Patterson. And the poem we're about to hear, Here's the Weather, has been viewed over a million times on YouTube. First, Stuart told me about the book, Wheen.
Well, Wheen has got a wheen of poems in it for hopefully lots of wheen of folk in Scots, and it's got 11 different themes, 11 different subjects, all the way for, well, Robbie Burns a wee bit, but also love, politics, where we are just now, and, you know, Dumfries and Galloway, the Solway, and also coronavirus. So it's quite up to date as well, but it's my poems, published poems in Scots for the past 30 years. So there's a wheen of them, aye. In 2017 and 18, I was the first BBC Scotland poet in residence. And for National Poetry Day in 2017, Janice Forsyth took a poll asking listeners to radio, or show on Radio Scotland, what their favourite Scots word was. And a lot of the words that folks suggested were about the weather, because we're Scottish, that's what we talk about. And folks' favourite word that they said was their favourite Scots word was dreich. So that made me think, can what talk that much about the weather that weather forecasts and news and all the rest of it on the telly should be done in Scots using all these words. So I wrote this poem about it called Here's the Weather, and they made a film, a wee film of it as well, and put it on the BBC site and on YouTube. The last time I looked, it's had about 1 million views, which is something else, which Scots abroad... seeing it and thinking, oh, that's what it used to be like in Scotland. I'm glad I moved to Australia. So this poem's called Here's the Weather. Today in London, the weatherman speaks of damp and of cold. In Scotland, it's dreich, with outbreaks of smur, the occasional hooly, advice in the papers to look out your willies, a sudden dramatic surge and spike in the sales of three-tiered winter dykes, the urge to girn and haver and blether, carnaptious for fochen and scunnert by weather. Dance round the double-edged sword of fash, ding down by the elements, loving stramash and the trochle of Baltic, funert and drukit, fair mollicates fears you're a diddy or stupid, your puckle concerns on the pound or on Brexit. It's the cant of the climate, and nobody gets it, eeksy-peeksy. We mump and we greet and we chove it, fae Lerwick to Perth, fae Kirkcaldy to Hawick. Gone on how we hadna a summer, it's affy, and on with the thermals and simmets and baffies. Gone out for the messages, ending up pecht with the hail Turravee. It's a geyser fecht against pavements like ice rinks and wrestling with wind in the nights that forever are fair drawn in. Shilpit and pootering and plootering awa' through the Dubs and the Glor and the Clart and the Snaw, stravagin' through Cundies and Shuchs, a galoot wi' your brolly destroyed and your breeks hanging out. the har and the vir and the flaggies and spitters, the snell air that scalps ye and gies ye the chitters, that makes ye doolally and drives ye to swally, and sunbeds and creams, to be less, peely wally. It's the weather of language, the language of weather, penning us, writing us all in together, the patter like latter that Obadi kens, for the schemes to the islands, for high rise to glen, for Stushy to Fankel, to Bowrach, to Drek, were steeped in the downpour of dialect, which fists and bumbazes and shuggles and heezes, skites, dites, invites us, unites us, and frees us.
Thanks to Stuart Patterson. Ween isn't available as an audiobook just now, but to hear many of the poems read out, just type Stuart Patterson into YouTube. And for four new books entering the Talking Books Library, here's Lynn Livingston.
First up this week, we have a very popular psychological thriller. Everyone Here Is Lying by Shari LaPena was donated to us by Penguin Random House.
They don't speak as William walks her to her car parked behind the motel. They never leave their cars out front where they might be recognized. No one will ever know they were here. At least this is what they tell themselves, what they have told themselves every time over the last few months, as their affair kindled, burned brightly. But now it has been abruptly snuffed out by her. He didn't see it coming.
Welcome to Stanhope, a safe neighborhood, a place for families. William Wooler is a family man. On the surface. But he's been having an affair that ended horribly this afternoon at a motel up the road. So when he returns to his house devastated and angry to find his difficult 9-year-old daughter Ella unexpectedly home from school, William loses his temper. Hours later, Ella's family declare her missing. Suddenly Stanhope doesn't feel so safe, and William isn't the only one on his street who's hiding a lie. As witnesses come forward with information that may or may not be true, Ella's neighbours become increasingly unhinged. Who took Ella Wooler? Nothing will prepare you for the truth.
They'd met at their usual motel on the outskirts of town, where no one knows them. It's on the main highway. They had to be discreet. They couldn't meet in their own homes because they're both married, and she, apparently, wants to stay that way. Until half an hour ago, he hadn't really had to think about it. He feels like he's had a rug pulled out from beneath his feet, and he still hasn't regained his balance. They stop at her vehicle, and he leans in to kiss her. She averts her face. Despair and desperation take hold, the realization that she really means it. He turns quickly and walks away, leaving her standing there. Keys in her hand. When he gets to his car, he looks across to her, but she is already starting the engine and driving away in a burst of speed, as if making a point. He stands there, bereft, watching her go. Something had seemed different about her today. He always arrived at the motel first, checked in, paid in cash, got the key, and texted her the unit number. Today, when she knocked and stepped inside, she'd pulled him close and kissed him more hungrily than usual. There were no words.
Everyone Here Is Lying by Shari LaPena is read by January Lavoie and runs for 9 hours 29 minutes.
Headline have donated a mystery story called The Beloved Girls by Harriet Evans.
When did it begin to fall apart? Afterwards, she would look back to this point in time, the arrival back home, though she never knew precisely when the moment itself came, the tipping point, so that the weight of what she carried grew heavier and heavier, and the scales simply could not be balanced anymore.
Catherine, a successful barrister, vanishes from a train station on the eve of her anniversary. Is it because she saw a figure, someone she believed long dead? Or was it a shadow cast by her troubled, fractured mind? The answer lies buried in the past. It lies in the events of the hot seismic summer of 1989 at Vaines, a mysterious West Country manor house, where a young girl, Jane Lestrange, arrives to stay with the gilded Grand Hunter family, and where a devastating tragedy will unfold. Over the summer, as an ancient family ritual looms closer, Janie falls for each member of the family in turn. She and Kitty, the eldest daughter of the house, will forge a bond that decades later is still shaping the present.
It was good to be home. The ice storm the papers had feverishly christened the Beast from the East had lingered well into March, and Catherine's usually brisk walk into chambers in Holborn had been hampered for weeks now with frost and slushy brown snow. It seemed they were always in the hallway, struggling into layers of clothing. It had been a rotten Easter, freezing, sleeting weather. But a few days into April, the weather became deliciously warm. Waking up at her beloved in-law's house in Albi in southern France, the sound of doves cooing in the dovecot in the garden, the fragile pale blue skies carved up only with the occasional swallow heading back north, Catherine would check her phone to see what it was like back in London, wondering why every morning she felt such dread at the prospect of going home again. Usually she loved spring. Not summer. Never summer. They'd been visiting David's family for just over a week, and she hoped that a new chapter could begin now, after their return. A new school term, the end of a long, brutal winter. The end of the Doyle case. She shook her head, thoughts crowding in on her, the image of an inbox filling up again. First, getting back into the swing of work, normal cases again. The prospect of visiting Grant Doyle in prison, not a welcome one. Then a visit to the care home. Then getting Caris to do some work for her exams. "Catherine," said David, as their daughter stomped upstairs, "come inside, my love. Pour me a drink. I will bring in the rest of the bags from the car." "It's all done," said Catherine briefly, smiling at him. She stepped over the threshold, inside the house, inhaling the old smell of home, furniture polish and wood. The faintest scent of spicy sandalwood from a carved box on the mantelpiece in the sitting room, bought during their 20th anniversary trip to Marrakesh. "You confound me, woman," said David. He gave her a small kiss. "Are you glad to be back?" "Sort of." "Are you glad we went away?" "Yes, very."
The Beloved Girls by Harriet Evans is read by Siobhan Redman and lasts for 18 hours and 35 minutes.
Headline have also donated the autobiography of actress Pamela Anderson, Love Pamela.
The lines blur between dreams and reality, or where I end and the world begins. To live and dream is a wicked dance. My dreams often come true, a curse and a blessing. Now that I've come full circle, I finally feel safe. I've stumbled upon a kind of love that will sustain me. Not only a practical, friendly, and compassionate love, a romance full of fairies, nymphs, and magic. A true love story. The love of self. More likely, a tender forgiveness.
Pamela Anderson's blonde bombshell image was ubiquitous in the 1990s. Discovered in the stands during a Canadian football game, she was quickly launched into superstardom, becoming Playboy's favourite cover girl and an emblem of Hollywood glamour and sex appeal. Yet, the Pamela Anderson we think we know was created through happenstance rather than careful cultivation. Love Pamela brings forth her true story, that of a small-town girl getting tangled up in her own dreams. Growing up in Vancouver Island, the daughter of young, wild and unwittingly stylish parents, Pamela lived a hard, scrabble childhood, but developed a deep love for nature, populating her world with misfits, apparitional friends and injured animals. Eventually overcoming her natural shyness, Pamela let her restless imagination propel her into a life few can dream of in Hollywood and the Playboy Mansion. As her star rose, she found herself becoming a fixture of tabloid fodder at the height of an era where paparazzi tactics were bent on destroying a person's image and self-esteem. Pamela forged ahead with grace, finding sanctuary in her love of art and literature, and emerged a devoted mother and activist. Now, having returned to the island of her childhood after a memorable run starring as Roxy in Chicago on Broadway, Pamela is telling her story, a story of an irrepressible free spirit coming home and discovering herself anew at every turn. With vivid prose interspersed with bursts of original poetry, Love, Pamela is a pensive, layered and unforgettable memoir.
Good habits are hard to recognize in the context of all my past and present decisions. There is no right or wrong, just personal fixations based on one's history, trauma, innocence, and education. I was always told I was unmanageable. Nobody agreed with my choices. Maybe that's a good sign. I was on no path but my own. I was a hands-on parent. No nannies, the boys' baseball game schedules written into my film and TV contracts. My children always came first, no matter what. Nobody can take that away from us. A rarity in Hollywood. I was, and still am, an exceptionally easy target. And I'm proud of that. My defenses are weak. I'm not bitter. I don't have the craving to be hard, heard, or taken seriously. I prefer to be fluid and free, without boundaries, leaving life to chance and destiny. Give me something else I can't handle, I'd say, up for the challenge. Life is a series of problems we must navigate with grace. One problem solved, another arises, again and again until we die. I bumble along, pushing those closest to me to new, annoying, and inspiring places, asking of others only what I demand of myself. I'm a little girl born of eccentrically beautiful, creatively codependent, unapologetic women who were much too good for any man. A collective mermaid society, living in sandcastles, dreaming under seaweed duvets, oyster shells for dinnerware. My mentors were fierce, in cotton candy bouffants, sturdy and wise, yet weirdly fantastic. I've been fortunate to have the feminine wild spirit, whimsical and ever-present, swirling around me, from my bombshell mother to the unique women who raised her, rebel beauties in Philip Tracy berets, bent with blue water tactics, sassy secret weapons, tried and true behaviors, harmlessly loving and unabashedly sexy, a sensuality armed with fantastic family recipes. Love and seduction. The way to all men's hearts is through their stomachs, and also their starving minds. I was taught to never give up or relinquish the chase. Keep it interesting. Don't be too easy. To be such a girl these days has the opposite signal: taboo, frustrating, unpatriotic, or problematic.
Love, Pamela by Pamela Anderson is narrated by the author and runs for 5 hours and 29 minutes.
And finally, for those who love historical fiction, we have Napoleon's Last Island by Thomas Keneally. It was donated to us by Scepter from the Hachette Publishing Group.
To the side of the long lawn of the Briars, and atop a knoll approached by rock steps, stood a cottage, built to charm with artful wooden fretwork. It was called the Pavilion, was a sort of summer house, with big windows on all sides, so it could be opened up and rinsed through by the kindlier winds that favoured our little dale. It was ornate, a jewel of a place, with a large room on the ground floor. Upstairs there were a few garret-style bedrooms. My father had already been told that people would want to rent this place, a naturalist from a ship had spent some time there, as had officers on short appointments ashore, and any other visitors, military or official, to our island. Occupancy was intermittent, though, since many preferred to live down in the town at Mr. Porteous's boarding house, the Portions, which rented small but comfortable rooms. It was a common axiom that the longer you spent in Jamestown, the less you felt cramped in by the great vices of rock either side of the town. I myself came to love the place. It was the only town to go to town to.
On the island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic Ocean, Napoleon spends his last years in exile. It is a hotbed of gossip and secret liaisons, where a blind eye is turned to relations between colonials and slaves. The disgraced emperor is subjected to vicious and petty treatment by his captors, but he forges a relationship with an unexpected ally, a rebellious British girl, Betsy, who lives on the island with her family and becomes his unlikely friend. Based on fact, Napoleon's Last Island is a surprising story of one of history's most enigmatic figures and a British family who dared to associate with him. It is a tale of vengeance, duplicity, and loyalty, and of a man whose charisma made him dangerous to the end.
The Pavilion would become the engine of Balcombe destiny, but one couldn't have guessed to see it glimmer on its mound to the South American side of our garden. For now, the garden favoured my nature and gave me room for unruliness. Storeship captains who stayed in the Pavilion with their wives did not do so a second time, and that was probably because of me. My spying, my intrusion, my hectic and impudent nature. I was a child with the gifts to be decorative, but I did not sit still enough to adorn any scene, exterior or interior. The supposed wildness and taste for frank talk I was later accused of had shown its early signs. I accepted, as one unthinkingly accepts air for breathing, my parents' making of their way on the island. My sister Jane was a wonderful playmate, since she lacked all unnecessary competitive spirit, all spitefulness, everything that I had in abundance. She was capable of firmness, though, displayed only when essential. We were the Balcombes' two girl children and did not question why there was no son. Our brother, William, was delivered at the hands of the island's English midwife a full 4 or so years after we came to the island. This birth seemed, at least to me, to occur with no fuss, no pain, no expectation of loss of mother or child. I had not then discovered for myself that giving birth is the equator, the dangerous passage between the poles of new life and death, which participates of, and can deliver, both. I knew nothing. I must have some form of education before I was too old. My parents had resolved that they would take a consistent line on this. No young tutor had answered our newspaper advertisement before we left England. Jane and I had an intermittent series of teachers, but tutors were not native to the island and impossible to attract from England or the Cape. At some stage, it was set in stone. We would have to go back to England to pick up some of that commodity.
Napoleon's Last Island by Thomas Keneally is narrated by Edwina Wren and David Trednick and runs for 15 hours and 2 minutes. Thanks to Lynn Livingston. And staying with Napoleon. Napoleon, A Life in Gardens and Shadows by Ruth Scar. It's a portrait of Napoleon written for our time, not in power, politics or epic battles, but through his love of nature and the gardens that gave his revolutionary life its light and shade. Napoleon's gardens ranged from his childhood olive groves in Corsica, to Josephine's gardens and menageries in Paris, to gardens in Cairo, Rome and on Elba, to the walled garden of Hougoumont at the Battle of Waterloo, and ultimately to Napoleon's final garden on St. Helena, where Chinese labourers built him a summertime house where he could sit and scan the sea in his final months. The audio version is read by Tanya Kubrick.
After he was sent into exile on St. Helena at the age of 46, gardening was Napoleon's last burst of activity before he died. On the advice of his doctor, he made an elaborate garden where sunken paths helped him evade the surveillance of the British guards. He swapped his iconic bicorn hat for a battered straw one and set about cultivating the only patch of ground remaining to him. His interactions with the natural world at the end of his life resonate with those of every man or woman who enjoys gardening in retirement or in retreat from the stresses and strains of the world. But Napoleon was no everyman. Earlier in his life, his relationship with nature was determined by his ambition. First, to advance himself within the chaotic aftermath of the French Revolution, and then to become the most important and feared man in Europe. Even in exile, there were echoes of grandeur in the extensive and meticulous plans he laid out for his last garden.
It's a biography that follows him through his life, the rise of his power and the decline of his power, by tracking him through the gardens that he passed through.
And the gardens themselves, the size of those reflect the size of his power.
Absolutely. So we start off with a very tiny garden when he was at school. Also the mulberry nursery that his family had on Corsica. And gradually move through larger and larger gardens, some in Paris, one in Egypt when he's on the campaign in Egypt, until we get to the grandest garden scheme of all, which is to construct a huge garden at the centre of Rome and also one connecting the Louvre and the Tuileries Palace in Paris, and finally to have a new palace on the banks of the River Seine, and going to have an immense garden to go with that as well.
Napoleon spent 5 years at the military school in Brienne-le-Château and 6 on St. Helena. These blocks of time enclose his life like bookends. They are the periods during which he had little control over the conditions of his everyday life and found refuge in growing plants. In between his first and last gardens, the arc of his life rose towards the sky before falling back down to earth. As his power grew, then declined, he rarely had time for gardening himself, but he passed through many gardens, large and small, public parks or private green spaces, admiring them. Often he ordered improvements, commanding other people's labour, always imagining a grander garden than the one that existed.
As part of your research, I know some of them never existed or some of them won't exist anymore, but did you visit as many of the gardens as you could?
I did, and then COVID came and I had just visited Fontainebleau. So I had previously been to Elba, but I haven't yet made it to St. Helena. Very much want to do that. But a friend of mine, his son was posted, he was a police officer in the Met, and he was posted to St. Helena, and his father went to visit him, and just a week ago, he showed me the photographs, and I could recognise a huge amount of what he was showing me from the descriptions that were left by Napoleon's staff and the memoirs of that garden that he created there.
He was a garden watcher and enthusiast, alert to the science and art of cultivation. He valued gardens as places to walk in at his own pace, and he reflected on the frenetic events by which he hoped to secure the future of France. For someone almost always in motion and in a hurry, more often at war than not, gardens offered rare opportunities for calm and pleasure. They were a counterpoint to the many battlefields, discrete settings in which the terrain and the weather were as important as they were in combat, but for creative, not destructive purposes. On two significant occasions, one at the start of Napoleon's career, the other at the end, a garden became a battlefield and the distinction was lost. The first was the Tuileries Gardens in central Paris, where in 1792 he witnessed the massacre of Louis XVI's Swiss Guard and the fall of the French monarchy. The second was at the walled garden of Hougoumont at Waterloo. In both these gardens, the piles of dead and mutilated bodies formed a terrible contrast with horticultural attempts to impose order on the natural world.
Now, the audio version is read by Tanya Kubrick. Did you have choice in the narrator?
So they send, if you're not going to do the audiobook yourself, they send some samples of people who they think would do a good job, and then you choose one of those.
Have you done any of your books yourself?
No, not yet. I would be prepared to, but so far I haven't been asked to.
Now, one thing we don't get when we download the book from the RNIB Talking Books Library is the cover. Can you describe the cover for us? Because it's quite an unusual image.
I was thrilled by this cover. So it was designed by a man called Eric Wilder in the United States. And I always credit the designer because he did such a beautiful job for me. And what he's done is to take two very famous images of Napoleon. One, him leaning on the spade in St. Helena, and he's got his straw hat in one hand, and that behind that is the iconic image of Napoleon crossing the Alps from the David painting, and that's in silhouette on the background. And then he has put green, and the cloak Napoleon was wearing is green to reflect the gardens. It was just a beautiful imaginative response to the book, and I was so grateful to him.
So it's more a book about Napoleon the man rather than the emperor.
Yes, but obviously, you know, it covers the period where he is emperor, and you see him changing from being the young soldier, he's almost a sort of soldier of fortune, and then becoming emperor is part of the story. But it's actually quite a relatively brief time that he's emperor, and then there's the fall, and then there's the exile afterwards.
And just finally, is this your first visit to Wigtown?
It is my first visit to Wigtown, and I have long wanted to come to Wigtown, and I will definitely be coming back.
Napoleon wanted to impose order on France and dreamed of expanding the nation's territory within Europe and beyond. In 1802, when he was first consul and not yet emperor, Samuel Taylor Coleridge described him as Poet Bonaparte, layer out of a world garden. Almost a decade later, despite his dismay at the violent outcome of Napoleon's power, Coleridge proposed a series of lives from Moses to Bonaparte of all those great men who in states or in the mind of man had produced great revolutions, the effects of which still remain, and are, more or less, distant causes of the present state of the world.
Napoleon, A Life in Gardens and Shadows by Ruth Scurr is available now as an ebook, in print and in audio, as read by Tanya Kubrick. You're listening to Read On, recorded live at the Wigtown Book Festival. In attendance this year was Louise Doughty, author of 10 novels, including Platform 7, recently filmed for ITV, Blackwater, a New York Times notable book of the year, and the bestseller Apple Tree Yard, which was adapted for BBC One. She was at Wigtown to talk about her new book, A Bird in Winter, the audio version of which is read by Claire Corbett.
Outside the restaurant, I shoulder my rucksack, and as I cross the road, I glance back at the small glow of it. Perhaps the thought I had then was a kind of premonition. Should I go back and talk to those two fellas, after all? The restaurant was warm. Inside it, I was safe.
A Bird in Winter is a novel about a woman who goes on the run. When the book opens, you find her in a meeting in an office block in Birmingham, and something's just been said, you don't know what, and she's rising from the desk and she's thinking it's no more than 30 paces to the lift. And from there, she goes on the run up to Glasgow, and it takes place in Scotland, Norway and Iceland, which is where her flight concludes. During the course of the book, you find out who she is and why she's on the run.
The heavy meal has made me sluggish. I hope I can find the guest house quickly. I imagine myself in a wide, cosy bed. I will be asleep within minutes. I walk in the direction the waitress described, along the dark streets of Thurso. No one else is around. The occasional car passes, but I'm the only person on foot. It's often the case in small towns, where everybody needs a car to get anywhere. To my right is the distant rumble of the sea, audible as a bass note beneath the high alto of the wind. It is cold now. The moon is a pale smudge behind the cloud. The waitress described a narrow side street to the left at the point where a wall ends. 5 minutes' walk up that, she said, just past the postbox, is the guest house. I turn at what I think is the right place, and suddenly am bathed in the icy white glow of a security light. I'm halfway up someone's drive. From inside the house, directly ahead of me, there comes ferocious barking. I do a brisk U-turn, hoping that the householder isn't the type to release the dog to investigate. I get back to the main road, with my heart thumping a little faster, and increase my pace. So much so that as the houses become sparse, I begin to think that, in the darkness, I must have missed the side street altogether. I stop where I am. The night is dark. The wind blows. The street is empty. Should I go back to find the guest house, or press on and find a sheltered spot to sleep rough, out of town? I can head to the ferry terminal at first light, after all. I'm longing for a bed. But some instinct is making me feel unwilling to turn and head back into town. Have I let the barking dog spook me? Something is wrong.
And you traced that journey yourself?
I did. I'd already visited Norway and Iceland before the pandemic, but then we closed down, so obviously that was a bit of a challenge. But as soon as restrictions opened up again, I went to Birmingham and I decided to follow her route. So I had a rucksack on my back and a beanie hat, and I went on the run. And the first thing I knew is that you can't use a car because of automatic number plate recognition. So she goes on the run on trains, buses, on ferries and on foot. And it was something of a challenge, shall we say. I'm not a particularly adventurous or brave person, but it was a very interesting trip.
Now, your books have been narrated by people like Juliet Stevenson, Richard Burnup, and this one, Claire Corbett. Do you have any choice in the narrators of your books?
I don't at all. I got quite excited with Apple Tree Yard because it was the first time I'd written a book that had a heroine who was the same age as myself, and I thought, oh, maybe they'll let me do the audiobook. And that was the point to which they said, Louise, we've got Juliet Stevenson, and, you know, you just have to hold your hands up. But obviously it's a very specialised skill to do it properly. And Claire Corbett, who's narrated A Bird in Winter, is a real rising star of Audible. She's very popular amongst the audiobook community, and justifiably so. She's done a great job.
Is it something you've done yourself before?
I've done short stories for the radio, but I've never actually narrated a whole book. Secretly, I would love to sometime. Maybe they'll let me one day.
Next time, definitely.
I hope so.
On my right, a stone wall stands between me and the sea, which is lost in the darkness, invisible. I can hear the waves crashing onto a pebble beach, a whooshing sound, followed by a low rumble as the retreating breakers drag pebbles and stones back into the water. On the left, the buildings have thinned to almost nothing. There are a few low, square houses set back from the road. Ahead of me, the road is swallowed by the night. I turn and look behind me. All is darkness, shadows. Around 100 yards back, there is a black vertical stripe of a lamppost with a small, contained pool of light at its foot. The wind blows and the waves crash, and I know I have no alternative but to keep walking and see if there is a place ahead where the town gives way to fields, because if I stay far enough ahead, it will be so dark out there, I will be able to hide. There's no doubt about it. I feel it in my bones. I am being followed.
A Bird in Winter by Louise Doughty is available now commercially in print, ebook, and in audio, and also available in audio from RNIB Talking Books.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community, from remote banking to TV remotes, call us on 0303 123 9999, or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world, you just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think Talking Books is the best thing ever.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio.
And finally, on today's show, part one of my trip to the Wigtown Book Festival, let's return to Lindsay May for the books of her life.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yeah, I think, well, actually, there's so many books from my childhood that had a lasting impression. Choosing just one, very, very difficult. But one that I think definitely influenced my reading habits for a while after was a book called The Reluctant Vampire by Eric Markham, which is a comedy tale of a young vampire called Valentine who did not want to suck blood and actually wanted to be a vegetarian. His father was very unhappy about it. I think I read it around the age 7 or 8 and I was absolutely fell in love with that and the idea that books could be that. It felt like a grown-up book, but it was obviously still a child's book, and it completely fell in love with it.
Despite an extensive search, we couldn't find an audio version of The Reluctant Vampire by Eric Morecambe, either in the RNIB library or available commercially. It is about to become a BBC TV series, so who knows in the future. Books by Eric Morecambe that we do have in the library are Mr. Lonely, his first novel, and Eric and Ernie, the autobiography of Morecambe and Wise. And is there a book on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with again and reread?
Yeah, I think a book that I would love to reread and have read a couple of times now over the years is Time Traveller's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger, which just, I remember the first time I read it, crying absolute buckets. I've gone back again and cried as much. And I think on the right kind of rainy day, it's definitely the sort of thing that make you feel a lot of feelings.
How does it feel? How does it feel? Sometimes it feels as though your attention has wandered for just an instant. Then, with a start, you realize that the book you were holding, the red plaid cotton shirt with white buttons, the favorite black jeans and the maroon socks with an almost hole in one heel, the living room, the about-to-whistle tea kettle in the kitchen, all of these have vanished. You are standing, naked as a jaybird, up to your ankles in ice water, in a ditch along an unidentified rural route. You wait a minute to see if maybe you will just snap right back to your book, your apartment, etc. After about 5 minutes of swearing and shivering and hoping to hell you can just disappear, you start walking in any direction, which will eventually yield a farmhouse, where you have the option of stealing or explaining. Stealing will sometimes land you in jail, but explaining is more tedious and time-consuming, and involves lying anyway, and also, sometimes, results in being hauled off to jail. So what the hell? Sometimes, you feel as though you have stood up too quickly, even if you are lying in bed half asleep. You hear blood rushing in your head, feel vertiginous falling sensations. Your hands and feet are tingling, and then they aren't there at all. You've mislocated yourself again. It only takes an instant. You have just enough time to try to hold on, to flail around, possibly damaging yourself or valuable possessions. And then you are skidding across the forest-green carpeted hallway of a Motel 6 in Athens, Ohio, at 4:16 a.m., Monday, August 6, 1981. And you hit your head on someone's door, causing this person, a Miss Tina Schulman from Philadelphia, to open this door and start screaming because there's a naked, carpet-burned man passed out at her feet.
The Time Traveller's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger is read by Russell Bentley and Sarah Mennell and available from RNIB Talking Books.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, so actually, along the vampire theme, which is kind of fitting because we're not quite at Halloween yet, but around that time of year, I've just finished reading Women Eating by Claire Coda, I think it is, which is just a fantastic spin on the sort of vampire myth or trend. And it's just a really enjoyable, contemporary, jazzy book. Really enjoyed it.
Do the lights dim? I ask, and Ben nods. I go to the switch and try it. The lights go down until they're almost off. I leave them at their lowest, and for a moment, the room looks like it is just made of shadows. Then my eyes adjust, and I can see everything. Ben squints in my direction, frowning slightly. I like it, I say. Okay, great. You'll take it. Yep. Let's sit down with the contracts then. So, shall we? I realise that he is expecting me to turn the lights up again. Okay, I say, but I don't go to the switch. I go to the table and sit down in the half light, hoping that he will just go with it. He does. He stumbles a bit on his way to the table, over nothing. People, I think to myself, have appalling night vision. And he sits down. He spreads the papers on the table. Then he looks up towards me. In this light, his features look very soft, whereas outside he had looked slightly more angular. I take in his cheeks, which are round and tinged pink. He must be quite young. He's fairly good looking. I smile at him. Ben puts one of his hands in the other and then says, "Would you mind if I..." And he points to the light above our heads. He begins to stand up. "Actually, would you mind if we just left it?" I ask. "I'm getting a headache," I add. "Oh, yeah, sure. I've got some ibuprofen, if you want." Ben reaches towards his bag, next to him on the floor. It's a nice, velt-looking cycling bag. I shake my head. "It's okay. I'm good. I'm probably just hungry." And as I say the word hungry, my stomach rumbles. I shuffle on my seat to disguise the noise, but it's pretty loud and the empty room is particularly resonant. I feel embarrassed. Ben pretends he hasn't heard, which makes it even worse.
Woman Eating by Claire Coda is available commercially as read by Katie Lung. That's it for part one of Read On at the Whitetown Book Festival. Coming up in future editions of the show, we'll have Joe Caulfield, Maggie O'Farrell, Michael Morpurgo, Kate Moss, Rory Sellen-Jones and Nigel Planer. All to come on a future edition of Read On.